Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate all you sticking it out to the end here. My talk today is on the evaluation of adsorbed organics on biochar and practical and potential implications. I have to thank all the speakers before me for laying out a perfect groundwork for me to talk from. The one thing I kind of wanted to go over a little bit, though, is a little bit of history. If we look at biochar, what do we actually have? If we look back about 35,000 years ago, we used charcoal for cave drawings. That basically is our biochars. We've used that then in about 3,000, 4,000 BC as a fuel source. Then in the 2000 BC, we finally discovered that this magical black material could also filter water. And then it was up about the 15th century, we decided to go into mass production of it as charcoal. The pyrolysis, carbonization, and coalification that is actually the process of creating this carbonized material has very long research histories. The prior emphasis, however, has been on the creation of fuel products. We are looking at taking biomass and creating liquid fuels back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. As well, the solid byproduct that we're now calling biochar has been an unwanted residual. It basically was a waste product of the fuel production. So what has changed? Our overall purpose of the creation of charcoal has changed. We're no longer looking at it as a fuel source. We actually want to utilize this charcoal product as a means of carbon sequestration. This idea dates back to about the 1980s to the early 2000s, and this has been the real renaissance of biochar as this derivative for carbon sequestration. So you heard a little bit this morning about black carbon and all these residuals. What I have up here is the spectrum of the black carbon continuum. You've seen the Van Kempen plots. This is just a simplification, just looking at the oxygen to carbon molar ratios. What you see here is that we start at zero with pure graphite. Graphite has absolutely no oxygen present in its structure, and it would have a ratio of zero. The next step up is soots that go up to about the 0.2 molar ratio line. We then have charcoals and chars that fill this intermediate region from 0.2 to about 0.6. Everything that has an O2C ratio greater than 0.6 is actually a biomass. So overall, you see these dividing lines. The 0.6 is our separation between our actual biomass materials and our charred materials. In order to go across that line, we actually have to lose oxygen. That separation there between 0.2 to 0.6 is our actual combustion residuals. You've seen in all these SEM pictures today that when you look at a picture of a char, you're actually able to pick out, oh yeah, that looks like a wood cell structure, or that looks like a grass cell structure. We still have those relic structures present in our char. Once we go to an O2C less than 0.2, we no longer have those relic structures. They all disappear. We have reformed carbon molecules in a new structure than our original biomass. So this is important to remember in the back of your mind. So when we talk about biochar, biochar is part of this black carbon continuum. It is not a new division. It is not a single entity. It actually comprises the entire spectrum of this O2C ratio. And that's what I've tried to show here, where biochar is this entire black carbon continuum. So you've also heard today that we kind of have a variety of impacts from biochar. I wanted to put the good, bad, and the ugly, but of course, I didn't want to put ugly on a biochar talk. So we have a wide variety of impacts observed after we mix these biochars with soils. We have some people that have very short residency times. Other people have seen very long residency times. We have both positive and negative plant effects coming from biochar. We have variations in the soil abiotic properties. You heard a lot about water holding capacity today, pH changes. We also have impacts on greenhouse gas production from the soil following the mixing. Some people have seen stimulation. Other people have seen suppression of the greenhouse gases. So we've also seen studies where some of these initial effects are different than what they see in year 2, 3, 4, and 5 after the biochar mixing. So what is our fundamental driver behind these observations? Unfortunately, I don't have that full answer yet, but I have one little key that could be along that way. What we've looked at here is the actual adsorbed volatile compounds that are present on biochars. I don't actually have a paralysis unit in my lab. I wish I did at times, but we've looked and relied on other people to supply us biochars. I currently have evaluated 34 different biochars for their volatile organic signatures. They come from a wide variety of parent materials with about 14 different types that I'll refer to. The hard and soft woods, we have corn stover, corn cobs, the macadamia nutshells, peanut shells, sawdust, algae, coconut shells, turkey manure, swine manure, distiller's grain, chicken feathers, and grasses. So this represents an overall cross-section of all the available biochars that I've been able to put my hands on. We have carbon contents ranging from about 1% up to 84%. We have nitrogen contents going from 0.1 to 2.7. We have production temperatures that are all over from 200 degrees C up to about 850 degrees C. And I have just about every known process creating these biochars represented. We have fast, we have slow, we have hydrothermal, and we also have a new one called microwave-assisted pyrolysis. So what am I actually doing to see these volatiles? You can see here a diagram of the system. I use what's referred to as headspace thermal desorption mass spectrometry. This is a very common analytical technique. If you look in any of the OSHA guides for sampling volatiles in air, they collect these samples on charcoal tubes. Then they put the charcoal tubes in a desorber and look at how much is there. So that's what I kind of utilized as the basis for this method development, is if we're able to use this to look at what's there present on the biochar to begin with. So we put the biochar in a sealed vial. We use about half a gram so that we can compare across the various spectra to see how the fingerprints overlay. That first is heated up to 150 degrees. All the volatiles that can be released at that temperature goes into the headspace. The unit then pressurizes that headspace with a little bit of helium so that headspace sample can be passed through the sample loops. That is then injected onto the various analytical columns, and eventually it gets over to our mass spectrometer to tell us what exactly that compound is. And on the bottom, you see our little system shown there in the photo. It has the nickname of Sparky. There is a lot of work that we had to do to get all this plumbing figured out, and there was one day my technician and I were in there working, and we actually shorted out our headspace unit because the tubing crossed the two grounds between the mass spec and the headspace sampler, and they're at different potentials, and we fried the motherboard of our little headspace unit. So that's why it's actually called Sparky. So what do we actually see when we do this? This first slide that I have here is what I'm referring to as our feedstock variabilities. These were all equivalent pyrolysis temperatures, but they were different units, because like I said, I don't have a unit, so I can't actually do a detailed study looking at the temperature equivalencies. So what I have here is the various representatives of soft pine, a manure swine, a hardwood, a wood pellets, and a corn stover. What I want you to see just in here is that we do have a wide variety of peaks showing up here. In gas chromatographs, you get the lighter compounds coming out first, or those would be the peaks over to the left-hand side of the screen. And as you move over to the right-hand side of the screen, we get larger and heavier molecular weight compounds. So instead of just looking at those little fingerprints, I selected three aromatic compounds to look at the various feedstock variabilities here. The top graph shows our benzene. And the other side note is this is thermal desorption. This is not total material that is present on these biochars. The difference is when you just use thermal desorption, you only get off what can come off in equilibrium at 150 degrees. We are not exhaustively extracting this material. We are just seeing what's available at that temperature. At that 150 desorption temperature, you can see we get a wide variety of the amounts of benzene that we would quantify in that sample. There really is no clear distinction between feedstock or parent material types in this. There really is no single feedstock that we say, well, this would produce a very clean char from the benzene perspective. And there's really no feedstock that would say, oh, that would create an extraordinarily high benzene signature. The next compound there is the toluene. The only thing I'd like to draw the attention to is that little circled 10 value, the 10 ppm of toluene that we found on a hydrothermal algae char. This gets into more of the mechanisms of how these chars are produced, but more importantly, what happens after they are produced. all these different techniques of producing chars produce different characteristics during the creation. You can think of these materials as being able to absorb anything that's present in that chamber when they're being created. And that's going to be a function of whether you do a nitrogen purge through the actual chamber, or if they're just sealed, and then it can interact with all the pyrolysis gases that are produced and potentially absorb more. This hydrothermal algae char was produced that way, where it was in a sealed container, everything was allowed to interact for a long time at the 200 degrees C, and that potentially could explain why we have higher organics on that particular char. And the bottom one is naphthalene. Naphthalene is a very bad compound to analyze by thermal desorption. I wasn't even anticipating to be able to see naphthalene in a thermal desorption technique, but we did actually see quantifiable amounts of naphthalene. So if we look a little bit at the temperature dependencies, this is where it gets really interesting, seeing all the NMR data that's out there and seeing exactly what compounds the NMR is seeing. If we start with the corn stover biomass at the top, we see a lot of aldehydes. In fact, the entire spectrum of volatile organics is dominated by aldehydes. And so those are your propanols, your 2-methylpropanols, your 2,3-butanionones, and we have the hexanol and the furfurols. They're all within the aldehyde class of organic compounds. When we look at a 200-degree char that was baked for 1 hour, all of a sudden you can see that we lose those aldehydes. We go over to more of a ketone-dominated spectra, where we start seeing the appearance of multiple bonded compounds. This fits with the whole theory of what happens during carbonization. The next step up, we went to 400 degrees C, and all of a sudden we start seeing the acetone, acetonitrile, and we have the first appearance of benzene, toluene, and phenols, and then we have the 2-methyloxyphenols. These are the first steps of the aromatic compounds. I should note that all of these chromatograms are scaled equally, so even though it looks like they're very small peaks, those are the particular peaks dominating the volatile organic signatures. Then we go down to the 600 degrees C, and we see again that we have the benzene, toluene, but now we get the presence of ethylbenzene, xylenes, along with naphthalenes. You notice we've lost entirely all the aldehyde ketones, as well as all the phenols that were present at 400 degrees C. So this just kind of summarizes what I was saying as I was going through the slide. As we increase the pyrolysis temperature, we lose oxygen-containing compounds. That really is no mystery. We were anticipating this to happen, but it's always nice when things work out the way you think it should. The other thing is that we go from aldehydes down to ketones, and as we increase the temperature, all of a sudden we start seeing the disappearance of all the aldehyde and ketone compounds, and we actually create the aromatic compounds. So then I started looking at all the chromatograms that I had for all these different chars, and I started seeing there was just wide varieties. I had chars that were absolutely had numerous peaks, and this is one of them that I've shown on the top here. It's a softwood biochar that was created about 550 degrees. The only unique factor is this was only allowed to react for 5 minutes. The other char that I decided to compare this to was another softwood pine that was created at 550 degrees, but it remained at that temperature over 30 minutes. Look at the drastic difference that you see in the volatile signatures. The unfortunate part is I haven't fully identified all the compounds that you see up there. On these chromatograms, each individual peak is a unique volatile organic compound. The initial indications are that we get a decreased amount of the sorbed volatiles as a function of the creation temperature. What I've been looking at is all the wood smoke and wood particulate literature, because that's the direct parallel to what we have during pyrolysis. From that literature, you see that they have identified about 200 to 300 individual compounds that are found in wood smoke and wood particulates. For the biochars, we currently have over 400 unique organic compounds that are absorbed to these materials. That's just something to keep in mind, that we actually have an extraordinarily complex material coming out of this pyrolysis process. So once again, just as I showed before, the flash pyrolysis versus slow, we have different amounts of material showing that the longer we keep the material at that temperature, the cleaner the biochar that results. So what I've also looked at is, now that we know that these volatiles are on there, is there anything we can do to fix this? We've looked at various forms of activation. charcoal activation has been going on for about 150 years. We looked at using an acid, a peroxide, as well as steam activation, and you can clearly see that just by going through the charcoal activation process on the biochar, we've cleaned up the volatile signatures. So what does this all mean? The Denick study this year that was published showed that when you utilized a high volatile matter biochar, he had a decreased plant yield. Andrew Zimmerman also showed the relationship between the prediction of the stability of the biochar to the volatile matter, showing that how when you had an increased volatile matter, you had an increased loss of biochar. So all of these volatile organics are responsible for a lot of the microbial signaling that occurs in our soils. You have the acetylene block technique for denitrification, all the furfurols, benzene phenols have all been identified as microbial inhibitors. So all the basic summary of all this is looking at how and what we're adding to the soil could be a very important property to what response we are seeing from the soils. So kind of further to emphasize this point, I've been doing the greenhouse gas implications of biochar for some time. I've looked now at once I clean that biochar with one of the activation processes, I no longer see the suppression in the CO2 or the nitrous oxide production. So this really kind of indicated to me that these volatiles are a real big key in the role, particularly in the acute initial effects that we see with the biochars. So these volatile organics are an important driver, but they are not the sole determining factor. There are so many other facets, the pH, the cation exchange capacity are all important, but the reduction in the N2O production currently assigned to the biochars really appears to be related to these volatile organics. And it also has been related to the plant effects. So the headspace thermal desorption, as I mentioned, is a very conservative estimate. It is difficult to get these compounds to desorb from charcoal. And the volatiles can be cleaned through the thermal steam activation. And we're also looking currently at what effect compost would have. Currently, I can't draw any universal conclusions on this data because all these biochars came from a variety of sources and I don't have a unifying variable. I am currently looking at partnering with people that are able to produce chars from the same feedstock under the same conditions to get a better idea of what's happening. So overall, there's a lot of people to thank for this. As the companies that have been involved with me that have been taking a lot of the heat for the blame for creation of biochars, Dynamotive Energy, Best Energy, Northern Tilth, the NC Farm Center for Innovation and Sustainability, Nicasi, which is the research arm for the paper and pulp industry, the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center, Biochar Brokers, Chip Energy, as well as the USDA ARS Paralysis Biochar Initiative. And with that, thank you.
Uh, 200 degrees C.
With
a
steamer. Yeah, correct. This was a very homemade steam activation process. I basically heated water separately from the biochar. Once I got up to 200 degrees C, they got mixed together. So it is a very simplistic operation. The actual steam activation in the industrial scale is about 900 to 1250 degrees C. It is under an environment of carbon monoxide to fully oxidize the carbon material to a very stable aromatic form. Then they put in the steam to act the polishing agent to finish off all the surface functional groups.
Actually, I can add one more. Mm-hmm. And I can see once you do going through the acid washing, going through the animal studies, those levels of the compound, those are individual people compound, absorb on the surface, largely washed off. And acid can be reused again and again, so mm-hmm. that's another possible way of doing that.
Yep.
Did you say acetone? Acetone, yes.
Other questions?
Yep, both solution as well as volatilization. So it's not environmentally, it wouldn't be a very good ending procedure. A lot of this is solely in the research mode. So we're just primarily seeing, is it possible to get that stuff off? And the other interesting side is once we do clean that material, surface areas go up. This particular one had a surface area of about 1.5 meter square per gram. We went up to about 350 meter square per gram.
The question is for the previous presenter.
Sure.
Hydrothermal and the thermal production of the biochar, whether he had a chance to compare the functional groups at the surface of both systems when you are using poultry waste.
That question was for you.
You asked me about the surface area difference?
Yeah, when you use poultry waste, and you use poultry litter to produce hydrothermal the biochar as compared with thermal biochar.
And the surface area analyzed by both the carbon dioxide and the nitrogen gas, the thermal biochar has a higher surface area than the hydrothermal biochar. And also the micropore volume of the thermal biochar was also higher than hydrothermal biochar. So I did not go into the detailed surface mechanism. So it's not surface driven process, because hydrothermal absorb more two compound and compare for sulfur of the nitrate, but you have a lower surface area. So not surface driven process.
Any other questions, discussion?
Yeah, I'm wondering how many characteristics you were able to define upon activation and what differences you saw between the chars when various activation treatments?
Differences in terms of responses in the soil or differences in the char material itself. Activation generally creates higher surface areas. It also creates a very uniform surface chemistry. You can actually tailor, depending if you use an acid activation or a base activation or steam activation, you can target sorption of particular organic compounds. This is being done right now for everything from the Brita filters that are in your home up to air filtration at an industrial scale. If they want to trap a particular gas, they can tailor that activated carbon to a particular sorption chemistry. And that's really what activation is. It's another chemical thermal transformation of a carbonized product over to a specific targeted purpose for sorption is the typical activated carbon market right now. In terms of which biochar makes the best activation basis, we're just starting. I've only looked right now at the volatile organic sorption impacts and seeing that, well, yeah, we've cleaned them now. Now the next step is what can we do with this and what factors we need to do to optimize it.
Okay, thank you all for being here. We'll look forward to seeing you at the poster session. And let's thank our speakers one more time.